Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Gamarjoba, and welcome to the history of Saakashvili, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is episode 9, King Muzardbi. Enjoy the show. It happened that there lived a king, Muzardbi. He had no children except one daughter. The king had a big fortress, and every evening he had to shout from the tower to his kingdom to frighten the devs, who often invaded this kingdom's domain and slaughtered its dwellers. If Muzardbi shouted from his castle, that night the devs would not dare enter his territories. In this way, by shouting and yelling as far as his voice could reach, the king was protecting his kingdom. In the daytime, the king always carried his bow and arrows, and wherever his eyes caught the devs, he would tear off their heads like bulbs of onions. Muzardbi had a wife whose heart was beating for the eldest 12-headed man dev. Finally, death suddenly took away Muzardbi's life away, which made his wife very happy, since she had fallen in love with the man dev. But until that day, she could not fulfill her desire. Muzardbi's wife tried hard to keep her secret from her daughter. Nevertheless, the young lady guessed that her mother was in love with the dev, and she told her, "God has angered at us, and our king died. What will good God bring us if we stay here? Today or tomorrow, the devs will eat us without men to protect us. It is better if we escape to the mountains and spend the rest of our lives there." The mother really did not appreciate her daughter's thought and told her, "I am already old. Even if a dev or death takes me away, I will not care. You, my daughter, do as you would like, but I cannot drag my old body far away." The young lady replied, "We have to leave. Dress and come with me at this moment, or I will kill myself right in front of you." The mother was startled by such words coming from her daughter. Then they dressed and went to the mountains. They left behind the luggage they could not carry with them. They found a cave in the mountain and settled there. The mother and daughter acted secretly so nobody ever found out to where they escaped. Here in the mountains, they would gather and spread sweet grass over the cliffs to use as food, and so they lived and survived. Time and days passed by, and one morning, as usual, the young lady went to gather the sweet grass. While she was gone, her mother gave birth to a son, half gold and half silver. The mother picked up her son and placed him under a large stone. As soon as her daughter came back, she sensed that something had happened after she left and asked her mother, Why is it that you look so pale? Tell me at this moment, or I will kill myself in front of you. What could possibly happen to me, my daughter? Answered her mother. A poor child was born to me, and I put him under that stone. The young lady rushed to the stone, lifted it, and took out a beautiful baby boy, half gold and half silver. Because of the joy, the sky ceased to be a cover and the earth ceased to be a ground for the young lady. She said, "This must be some grace from God over us. The child is marvelous, and what a child! Tomorrow he looks better than today, and the day after tomorrow he looks better than tomorrow. And like no one can look straight at the sun, so one cannot keep gazing at his shining face. 3 days old, the boy looked like a 3-year-old, and soon he started walking. When he became 10 or 12 years old, he started hunting. Here he grabs wooden sticks and shoots and tears off birds' heads. After some time, the boy asked his sister to make for him something he could shoot with. The sister cut a wicker and made a plain bow and arrows for him. She pulled some hair from her head, then twisted it, made a twine, and stretched it on the bow. Since then, the child started hunting even better. He leaves in the morning, and at dusk, he comes home loaded with game, and so his sister and mother never lack food. The mother is not very pleased with her son's skills. As time went by, the child went farther and farther to hunt. He started coming home later and later in the evening. On one beautiful day, the boy jumped up, wanting to go farther to see more places to hunt. So he walks and approaches a hill. He looks ahead and sees there stand some fortresses and buildings. His father's castle reaches the sky. He has never seen such marvelous things in his life. Astounded, the boy wonders, "What could this possibly be that I see here?" He wants to find out, but there is no one around to ask. He desires to go down the hill to see those places closer, but he is afraid since sunset is approaching already, and he will not be back home in time, and his sister will start crying. So, what does he have to do? The boy thought, "Whatever will be, will be." Then, in the blink of an eye, he ran down the mountain and approached a house, but could not find anyone there. Then he tried another house. There is also no one there. He approached a third house, and there he saw an old woman sitting in front of the hearth. The old woman looked back and saw the handsome lad standing at the door. Then she asked, "You look like some Christian's son, dear boy. So why do you put yourself to death? Devs walk around here and slaughter humans. There is no one left this place except me, and the devs will take me too tomorrow. The palace that you see belongs to King Muzarabi, whose entire family was destroyed and left without a successor." Now the child found out everything about himself, who he was, and whose descendant he was. He rejoiced and then found out from the old woman when the devs would come there. So he jumped up and headed to the mountains again, back to his sister and mother. He also hunted a little on the way back home. At supper, the boy asked his mother, "Mother, tell me, where did we come from?" Mother answered, "We did not come from anywhere." The sister wishes to tell everything to her brother, but she is afraid of her mother. The child did not ask further questions. The next day, early at dawn, the boy jumped up and went to the place he had visited the day before. As soon as the old woman saw the boy, she rushed to him and greeted him, then kissed and embraced the child and related to him the entire story about King Muzarabi, everything she had known or heard. As soon as the child found out that his father's bow and arrows were kept in a castle, he ran and grabbed the bows and arrows and then told the old woman, "Don't move from the place where you are sitting." He himself went and hid behind the doors. After some time, there appeared a dev. He comes with such a sound that the whole earth shakes and rumbles around him. The dev approached the doors and was about to swallow the old woman, when suddenly the boy shot his arrow and shed the dev's brain on the floor. The old woman helped the boy. They buried the dev into the ground. Now that God sent the old woman such a savior, she rejoiced and regained her hopes. The child hid his father's bow and arrows nearby, then took his own bow and arrows and went home. On his way home, he hunted and killed some beasts and took the game to his sister and mother. The next day, he went back again, and now he watched for another dev. The old woman warned the boy that the other dev was about to approach the place. The child watched and heard the dev's voice. "Hey, you old woman, come over here and tell me where my brother went." The old woman acts as if she had not heard the dev's words. The angered dev approached the doors and was about to swallow the old woman when suddenly the child shot his arrow and tore the dev's head. The boy and the old woman buried this dev too. In such a way, on a third day, the boy slaughtered the third dev. Now, there was only the eldest flint dev left, who had 12 heads, and as everybody would say, there was no one capable of killing him. On the fourth day, the child came here again and waited for this dev to come. He said to himself, "Today, my fate will be decided." The ground, the house, and everything trembled around. "What is happening?" asked the child. "The flint dev is approaching the place," answered the old woman. And indeed, this dev comes and roars, "You old woman, drag yourself over here and tell me where my brothers have disappeared to, or your life will soon end." The old woman sits in silence as if she had not heard the dev's words. The dev opened his mouth and was about to swallow the old woman when suddenly the boy shot his arrow and tore the dev's 12 heads and threw them down on the ground. Now the child looks and sees that the 12 heads are again attached to the dev. He grabbed his bow once more and shot the arrow and cut off the dev's heads for a second time, but again the heads reattached themselves back to the dev. So there seemed to be no help. How many times the boy shot and tore off the dev's heads, they rejoined themselves to the dev again and again. At this moment, a small bird flew from somewhere, sat at the door, and started chirping, "Ashes and lye! Ashes and lye!" The old woman bustled and grabbed the clay dish, then dipped it into the lye. When the child cut the dev's heads once more, she poured ashes onto them. Again, the child and the old woman helped each other and cut the dev into pieces and buried the parts in the ground. The old woman told the child that as of then, there was nothing else in the world to be afraid of. Full of joy, the old woman forgot all the fears she endured before. She kissed the child and cuddled him. The tired boy went home in the evening. As soon as he came home, he went to sleep. The sister asked, "What is the reason you are so tired and weak?" The child did not say a word. The next day, he wanted to try his mother again and asked her, "Tell me, whose son am I?" The mother hid the truth once more. At last, the boy revealed to his sister and mother where he had traveled the past 4 days and who he had seen and what he had done. The sister could not wait any longer and told her brother, "You are the son of that Muzarabi whose bows and arrows you used to kill the devs." The mother excused her actions with the reason that she was afraid the devs would kill her child. The boy took his sister and mother and returned to his father's palace. After the sun went down, he climbed up the tower as his father used to do, and he shouted with such strength the stars in the sky started shivering. When people heard the sound, they were astounded and began asking, "What is happening here? How could Muzarabi revive from the dead, or who could possibly come here and take his place?" The next day, the news spread everywhere. Everyone, whether they lived in plains or mountains, gathered and went to the palace to find out who had come there. They almost reached the sky from joy when they discovered that Muzarabi's son had come and killed all the devs in their kingdom. They congratulated Muzarabi's son on becoming king and went back to their homes full of happiness. But the mother of this child was not happy with the flint dev's death. She found out where the flint dev was buried, and every day she would go there and water the grave. On the third day, she heard some voice from the netherworld. "Who are you, such a grateful creature, that you water me every day? Perhaps you could scrape a handful of soil from me?" So the woman scraped the soil. Suddenly, the earth opened and the dev emerged from the ground. This woman turned the dev into a fly and locked him in a chest. Some time passed by, and her mother brought some thumb-thick boots to her son and told him, "You don't resemble your father. He wore boots like this." The child was hurt. How is it possible that I don't resemble my father?" Then he took the boots from his mother and tried to put them on. Suddenly, while trying to fit into the boots, he twisted his foot and broke his right leg. The mother rushed to the chest and let the fly out. The fly became a dev again and struck the boy. They engaged in a fight. The child, standing on one foot, lifted the dev and set him into the ground up to his knees like a stake. The mother sees that her child is about to defeat the dev. She approached her son closer and spread grains of millet under his feet. The dev turned around and knocked the child on the ground, then stepped on the boy's chest with his feet and crushed him into pieces. The mother and the flint dev went up to the castle. The sister came and saw her brother lying on the ground, his body parts cluttered together like tinder. Swift as lightning, she gathered her brother's remains and put them into a sack and rushed to the mountain where they lived before. As soon as she came to the cave, she spread out her brother's remains, sat by his side for 3 days and nights, and cried. With tears in her eyes, the sister begged God to save her brother. On the third day, the boy moved and rose as if he awoke from a sleep. Then the brother told his sister, "I will now go home, and you two follow me after some time." The sister obeyed. Secretly, the boy came to the palace and told the old woman, "Go and run and shout, 'Muzadabi rose from the dead! Muzadabi rose from the dead!'" The old woman followed the boy's advice. She came out and started shouting. Once the mother and the dev heard these words, they hurriedly ran out. At that moment, the child rushed to the castle, grabbed the bow and arrows, shot the flint dev, and tore off his 12 heads. The old woman quickly spread the embers over the dev's heads. Then the boy chopped the dev into small pieces, made a big fire, and burned the dev and turned him into ashes. By that time, the sister came back too. She was rejoiced when she saw her brother's victory. The mother, after she found out that her son had killed the dev, went up to the tower and fainted there. Then the sister and the old woman told the child, "Until this day, we did not dare tell you that your father had a flying horse. The horse is still there, in the cavern. If you get that horse, then no troubles will ever stand in your way." Immediately, Muzadabi's heir went and found the horse and mounted it like a flying bird. The horse flew to the sky, trying to crash the rider, but the boy instantly placed himself under the horse's belly. Then the horse went down to smash the rider to the ground, but the boy positioned himself on the side. Now the horse tried to smash the child to the mountain, but the boy placed himself on the other side. Then he went, grabbed his mother's hair, dragged her out of the castle, and tied her to the tail of the flying horse. "My tale ends here. Yesterday I was there, and here I come today. 3 apples and 3 pomegranates. Enjoy the taste and be a guest. Let it be God's will that you will always have a fruit harvested by your own hand."
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois-Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois-Burgundy.
Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king, all before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story, and the story of the cultures that surround it, sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
And wasn't that such a lovely story? And now we are back, and this time I have a guest on the show, Benjamin Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia and why though. Hello, Benjamin. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
It's very nice to have you because our shows really do not cross over too much.
No. What? Why am I here? How did this happen?
Let
me out of your basement.
Well, not anytime soon, but
okay.
It's a nice rest for you. Mm-hmm. So essentially, I just wanted you to come on and experience a Georgian folktale, get your take on the story, and we could just kind of chit-chat about our thoughts on the matter, because it was a bit of a ride to read that story, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. a lot of, fascinating, like, folklore-y kinds of tropes. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of things that always drove me mad as a kid, like it just stopping. The stories don't have an end. They just stop.
Just like life. It just stops.
it makes you, like, it is kind of just like a thing that, you know, mm-hmm. we're really used to modern story structures. And, you know, that's just, obviously that wasn't always the case. But it does make me wonder about, like, the way these stories were written down. And, you know, was it like some, you know, sociologist or whatever? No, not sociologist, the other one. Anthropologist. Is it some like anthropologist going to a tiny village and finding the last old person who remembers these stories and is just like getting dictation from this old person, and the old person is some at a certain point just is like, I'm dies. Tired.
Or they just die in the middle of talking. That's when the story ends.
The castle.
Okay, that's the story. Yeah, cool. Well, I will say that this was translated by Sharina Kurtzikidze, who actually has a doctorate in a lot of these things. I forget what I mentioned in the first myth tale we read from this book. But she, one, she's Georgian.
Okay.
And two, she did go to these small villages and just transcribe word for word what they said and just translated it into English. And didn't change the format. She just, because her thought process was, oh, I'm just going to keep the format that these are said and just translate it straight into English. So we don't get like the grammar structure of like an American tale. We get the Georgian grammar structure.
Yeah.
Which you can tell was kind of a bit confusing at some points.
At some points. I mean, I don't know enough about the languages to, mm-hmm. there are definitely certain points where things came off weird, but for the most part, you know, it followed fine, I guess.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much of that is like, because like English is a really weird language. So I guess at some level, when you're translating it, you need to fix the grammar somewhat, because word order matters so much in English that mm-hmm. for things, you know, word order in English does things that endings do in other languages. I'm saying this to you like you don't speak multiple languages and I'm a monolingual American idiot.
Well, I speak a language, you see, but yeah, this, I kind of like the fact that Dr. Kurtzikidze preserves the original structure in which the story said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just kind of gives a bit of life to it instead of just having an Americanized or like anglicized, there we go, that's the word, anglicized grammar structure where, yeah, it makes more sense to us, but it doesn't give off the same oratory traits that you'd have in a language such as Georgian, or if it's this in Mingreli or Swanatian, because there's so many dialects in Georgia because it's a mountainous area.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely an editorial choice. I definitely like preserving the sense of the language there. Mm-hmm. I do wonder about, like, you know, there's never any one version of these stories. One thing with listening to, like, Thomas's podcast with the history of Aotearoa.
New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah. did I even pronounce that right?
Aotearoa, yeah, you did.
Yeah, so I love his folklore episodes because, and one of the things he says is that, you know, this is the version of the tale from this book There are like 9 different versions from all the different iwis and everything like that. So which makes me wonder, like, if this woman went like a valley over to the next village, would there be a different version of the story that like had an ending or just had, you know, something else entirely going on? And that's all, that would be really interesting too. Just like a book that's all one story, just told like 19 different times.
Well, actually, there's something like that that I did for Patreon for the
Okay.
goddess Dolly.
Sure.
Well, but I only chose the best ones out of that one. But Kevin Tweet up at he's a professor up in Canada. I forget which school. I should know these off the top of my head. I use them all the time. But Dr. Tweet essentially wrote down multiple variations of the different stories that he accumulated, and this is also helped by another professor who he referenced in his writings of Dolly, the goddess of the hunt. So yeah, there are multiple versions depending where you are, and especially they may have different names. Dr. Kutsukidze in this case, just I think she may have just picked her favorite out of the
Okay.
bunch
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. Yeah.
and just kind of put them down on paper, because the book I'm using is technically used for a class that she teaches, which is why it was
Okay.
so darn expensive to get.
Yeah.
Oh
Sure. Yeah.
man. So yeah, so essentially King Murzabi is not really a tale that I've heard, and surprisingly enough, it's not a folklore that I've seen in other similar situations when I've read different things, which is what I like about the Georgian Myths and Folktales book by Kurtzakidze, is that it kind of has folktales that don't go along with other
Yeah.
historical folktales.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
This one was a wild ride, though.
Okay, so tell me your thoughts on the whole story itself.
Well, I started off with my main thought, which is just like, man, this just falls apart at a certain point. And it's just like, and then they all came back to life, and then he flew into the fucking sky, dragging his mom along by her hair, and that's the end. Enjoy your food.
And here's a song.
But yeah, it's you could go into 90 levels of analysis, with any of these, but first off, I'm not super familiar with Georgian folk tales or anything like that, but one thing that stuck out is the Zoroastrian influence in terms of the devs. Like that they're like I'm trying to think to back to Trevor's podcast now. The Deva, right? There, I mean, this is obviously influenced by
Yes,
that.
very much so. It's literally in
Yeah, right.
the root, dev.
So, it's that's fascinating. The concept though that like there's like dev infestations, like they're just like a bunch of bees that are, inhabiting this valley and they won't go away.
Well,
You damn devs, get out of my the
no,
kid
but
going up on the roof.
it's an actual thing in Georgian folktale where, like, in most places you'd have like the crazy monster or you'd have like the dragon. In
Right.
Georgian mythology, it's a dev.
Right. Yeah.
Like, 'cause you can have a dragon dev, you can have a man dev, you can have an ogre dev. Like, it's funny to me because it's basically like, oh yeah, this is just some sort of like magical being who just takes the form of whatever is in front of it. So in this story, it was man devs. And one of Myth 3, Amiran, the Georgian Prometheus, he fought off, essentially his story is that he kills most of the devs in the world. Because he is like the big warrior, the Promethean figure. He brings fire and blacksmithing to the world. But the devs are a constant figure that you'd see a lot in Georgian mythology, and this was what I think it what separates it away from your other mythological types, because otherwise you'd have like, oh yeah, you'd have some sort of like a mythical animal, or a witch, a wizard. In Georgian mythos, you just have a dev who's a combination of everything, and they can shapeshift, they can do whatever.
If I remember some of your previous episodes, it's like they're kind of they're almost like demons in Japanese mythology, which I'm sure we're getting a poor translation of using the word demon to cover what they call it there too. But they're just sort of like, they're evil and powerful, but also like you can marry them if you want.
Yeah, like you mean like the kabukis or
I don't know what the original term is, but I just, you know, watch anime and see demons referenced.
Yeah. but it's like they're humanoid in shape. You can treat them as normal people, essentially.
They're not necessarily evil. They're just powerful and they don't care about you.
Exactly, and they'll eat humans. So
yeah.
It's like watching Yu Yu Hakusho.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes they'll care. Sometimes they're just going to eat your guts.
Yeah, and yeah, and they can, and you know, also they can take on different forms. They can be various animals in nature, or have a humanoid form when it's more convenient for the story, I suppose.
Of course, and I honestly, what I found interesting was the fact that the main character of the title name, King Muzarbi, the guy dies in the first three paragraphs.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's fantastic. Yeah. There's got to be like postmodern novels that do that.
Well, I think there is, or like a film where the guy dies in like the Ballad of Somebody. I've been having a bad time remembering names today, but there is a current day, like a modern day film where it's a ballad of something, of someone, and he dies within like the first, like, it's like several different stories in one whole movie. He dies in the first story, and then it's basically about his song and his story that lives on.
Right. Yeah.
So
that was fascinating. That was hilarious. One other thing that struck me was, you mentioned witches, and the prevalence of magic, and it's just kind of not even like a big deal that his mother just very matter-of-factly, she turns the nine-headed dev into a fly and puts him in a chest.
Well, can she do that?
I know.
Oh. Oh, I did not know. I use magic all the time.
And yeah, it's in a bunch of these folk tales, it's just like, yeah, people do that, mostly women.
No, it's usually the woman, and of course you have this like, one, she's an older lady. Two, the king's son, who I'm guessing is also Muzarbi by name.
Yeah.
He grows in like a few days to adulthood.
And is silver and gold colored. Yeah.
And at birth. Yeah.
One thing that I was waiting for was that he was going to be the son of the dev that his mom had the hots for.
That's what I was thinking when I was reading. It's like, oh, and then she gave birth and this is like, and oh, the son was gold and silver. I'm like, oh, is that a dev? And he's like, nope, he's the king's son. And I'm like,
that's, oh, Okay. Did that just happens then, I guess. You have.
Well, my thought is also that when they said he was a silver and gold child, was that he was a pale and blonde haired kid.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Because that's a thing in Georgian mythos where it's like you have someone who's blonde and pale, and that's like a standard of like high beauty and all that.
Right.
When everyone, you know, has dark tanner skin, darker hair, typically. It's because of the region, and you know, even the Dali, who's like the goddess of the hunt, is also like renowned, known to be like a huge beautiful woman who's silver, you know, pale skin, blonde hair. He has like a godlike essence is what I'm seeing more from that reading, versus he's just, you know, he just looks gold and silver like he's chromed up or something. That's just preem, you know.
yeah
And then just kind of, because you only have about four main characters in this whole book.
Yeah.
You have
three of whom don't get names.
Actually, most of the main characters don't have a name.
Oh, yeah. There's, yeah, it's the old woman, the mother,
The sister.
And the child.
And Muzarbi's son, yeah.
Muzarbi's son.
And then the devs. No one gets a name except for the guy who dies.
It's the only important one, really.
Well, I mean, how else do you make it equal?
Yeah.
You know, we can't complain about none of them having, about someone having a name when no one has a name.
Yeah.
It does make things confusing, though. And I should follow what Sandman Stories Presents does and just kind of give them all names.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because that also great show. Dustin was on episode 6. He kind of goes through folk tales and he rewrites them to kind of make them a bit more modern, or at least takes out all the content that wouldn't fly today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or and changes it to be more easy to you know, to read and take, because there's some stuff you read that was published in the 1800s and you're like, that's not good.
Yeah.
So he changes it to be more acceptable and like stops, you know, underage girls marrying old men. He makes them closer in age.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I like that he does that, which I should probably do for this thing and kind of give all these unnamed people names. But
I think that presenting it raw is the most amusing way possible to do this folklore stuff.
I mean, some of them, yes. Some other ones, I'm like, I do not want to say the N-word.
I guess, yeah. That'd be a problem.
Yeah. Especially because when you translate stuff from Russian to English or from Georgian to English, you're like, that's not a word we should be using.
Well, but why would you even use that word in the translation? You could pick one of the other ones.
Well, it depends if you're like, who's translating to.
Okay, that's true.
But that's just like a language thing. But typically, Georgian literature or folklore does not have that. Russian folklore has it sometimes, depending on when it was written.
Yeah.
But back to the name, the unnamed people. I found it kind of interesting that somehow the whole town has been eaten up by the devs.
Right.
But then it was just the old lady being around. But somehow there's enough people around the town to cry out in glee that the son is the new king.
Yeah. Well, they immediately, people immediately moved back into the valley as soon as the the devs were gone. They're just hanging around waiting.
I mean, I don't blame them. It's like, you get to be back at home? Heck yeah.
No, the original inhabitants are all dead. There's just like a bunch of people wandering around up in the hills.
just cool, free housing.
Just constantly wandering into the valley and getting devoured. And that's how the old lady stayed alive. She just made sure that the devs found one of the people wandering in first.
She always called out to the young men that came up that were rocking around. It's like, hey, someone's trying to eat me. I'll be a hero.
Yeah.
Nom nom nom.
And then when you know, this kid actually starts killing devs, she's like, oh, all right, well, that's cool too.
I need a hero. Yeah, it is. No, I found that interesting. And then the fact that he was able to find his dad's arrows, bow and arrows, made it like, oh, he has a nice magical weapon that lets him do things. And of course, it just kind of, I did enjoy the whole like graphic scenery with, yeah, he shot an arrow and then his brains went everywhere. I'm like,
yeah, definitely.
I thought that was enjoyable.
Yeah, the injury descriptions were fairly over the top.
And then, it's great.
Yeah.
That's what I live for.
It was just matter of factly. And then they buried his body. Like, they cut his body into like 40 pieces and buried it in the ground.
Yeah, and you know, just the whole thing, he kept trying to kill the 12-headed dev, and it's like, why won't you die? And it's like, oh, you gotta burn, you gotta cauterize the wound and put it in and lie. And it's like, oh, that makes sense. Can't grow when you sealed up.
Yeah, which is a, isn't that a thing in, so this is like a influence from Greek mythology or possibly vice versa. That,
probably the Hydra, yes.
Yeah, the Hydra thing, yeah.
Yeah, that is probably a reference to the Hydra, because the Georgians, at least back in antiquity, were very influenced by the Greeks, because the Greeks had a whole bunch of colonies along the Black Sea coast.
Right.
You know, Medea is from Georgia.
Right.
so, you know, they were down there looking for the Golden Fleece, and It's fun. It's funny because even the Georgian word for wise and the Georgian word for Greek are very close to each other. So wise is berzeni, and Greek is berzeni. So it's just, you know, there's an E in the berde and berd. So it's very close. They're like, oh yeah, the Greeks are the wise ones. That's we add an extra letter so you know they're Greek and not just wise.
I'm sure the Greeks love that.
Oh, absolutely. So you have, so this is like probably you can see some influence of, oh yeah, here's a story of the Hydra. Let's just have this kid slaughter the Hydra.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy the fact that his mom is like, let me water the dev's remains and he'll grow back to normal. I'm like, what?
Or, I mean, and then spread his remains over the cave floor and cry about them.
Oh yeah, what his sister did.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So
death is pretty broken. It's
but they can't bring back a man who dies of old age.
Yep, yeah, they've got a real DC universe problem going on in these folklore stories.
Oh, absolutely. And then one thing that I really was also found interesting was the use of current day Christianity as well. Within the story.
Sure, yeah, it was kind of a like a Beowulf kind of thing where it's like it the basic story got passed down from before Christianity, but a monk wrote it down, or you know, a Christian person wrote it down.
Yeah, and it's only mentioned once when the sister is, you know, praying for her brother to be revived.
Right,
so if anything, this kid is a Jesus-like figure. I'm gonna get so much flack for that.
Well, I mean, he dies and comes back just like the dev, I guess.
Well, the dev's a, you know, demonic entity, so I
right,
but no, it's just interesting to see that, as you mentioned, you have the monk who kind of writes a story and then has to add some sort of godly thing because you can't just have them praying to just some random Georgian god whose name we don't know, because right. Christianity did a great job of removing that information.
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of threw my Georgian Gods episode out the window, because we have information about Dolly and her son, Amiran, and that's it. Because Amiran's a famous figure. So any other thoughts that you had on the whole story, or that you just wanted to conclude with?
The whole ending, I was just like, it's been all about the devs and fighting over this castle, and then at the end it's like, oh, by the way, we've got Pegasus in a cave over there, and then it's just like a Dukes of Hazzard Greek style smashing all over the landscape and then grabbing his mom and dragging her by the hair. I don't know what that means, but probably means something.
Well, she did try to get him killed and broke his leg.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mother of the Year award, that's for sure. Yeah.
It's just it's just a fantastic image. Just have the story just take a complete left hook, and then yeah, in my mind there's just like crazy banjo music playing all of a sudden and slamming into mountainsides and running into the ground.
And just like the sun just moving along, the horse is shimmying around, like, oh no, he's going down. Let me get on the side. And it's like, oh buddy.
Pegasus is always, you know, such a noble steed, and this horse I can just imagine is just like frothing at the mouth, panicking.
Very hitty hitty hoo ha.
Yeah.
Or whatever the name is from the Narnia series. Horse and His Boy. But yeah, so first of all, can you tell people about your podcast?
No.
All right.
So Wittenberg to Westphalia is The Wars of the Reformation is a podcast that's theoretically about the Wars of the Protestant Reformation. But I am about 5 years into it. I'm almost at 100 episodes and I'm still working on the background. Right now we're about to really get into the investiture controversy. And so it's a wild ride. I like to tell people it's a comedy podcast about human suffering. And I think that kind of sums it up.
And how many years are you away from Wittenberg?
Oh, who knows?
I'm in the timeline.
In the time, well, I'm at, so I'm in the, around 1050 thereabouts. And oh no, wait, no, I'm later than that. So I'm around 1100 right now, and Wittenberg is, you know, 1516. So
you know, we're getting there.
Yeah, getting there.
If anything, I listen to Ben's show and it's fantastic. Consider it more of a history of Europe, which is just going to turn into the Wars of the Reformation.
Yeah, we'll get there.
It's a nice ride. You know, you learn a lot. My favorite episode is still the one you did about the scary story about the medieval sewage system.
Yeah, I am an urban planner by training, so whenever I get to urban topics or anything about infrastructure, maybe I delve into things a little bit more than your average person would. But people seem to like it.
It's fun. It's fun. Especially when you have someone who knows what you're talking about telling you about infrastructure. And because you can say, tell me about this village. It has houses in it, I guess.
Where do they go to the bathroom?
Outside?
These are important things to know.
Yeah, so Ben, where can people... go ahead.
Where do they go to the bathroom in relation to their water supply?
Oh, no wonder they all died of dysentery. So where can people find you?
So the podcast is Wittenberg to Westphalia, Wars of the Reformation. On Twitter, I refuse to use any other name. It is W2W Podcast. Same on Blue Sky. Facebook, you can just look for Wittenberg to Westphalia. Fans of the Reformation is the group. And and you can go to Google Wittenberg to Westphalia, Wars of the Reformation podcast, and you'll find my Weebly page, which has a unwieldy URL that I'm not going to share, but you can go there and get links to everything.
And I will put the links in the episode description.
Cool.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Ben, for joining us here today. It was fun chatting with you and being able to do this with you. So now we've both been on each other's podcast, which is great.
Yeah, and now we can go play Civilization.
Exactly. So, everyone, thank you, Didi, Madhavan, and Nakhvandis, and thank you for listening to The History of Sacramento, Georgia. See you next time.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.